Welcome to Partially Derivative, the show about data, data science, drinking, and awesomeness. Our top data-related articles and blog posts from the past week, all with great commentary and quite a bit of drinking, so enjoy that. Links to all the stories we discussed today are available on our site, partiallyderivative.com, and on Twitter, at PartiallyD. My name is Chris Albin, and as always, with me is my co-host, Jonathan Morgan. Before we start the show, we have three announcements. First, as always, we are available everywhere. We are on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, any place you get your podcast, we are available. Second, if you are listening on iTunes, we want your reviews. We want to share data science with as many people as possible, and your reviews are a great way to get our work highlighted for others. So if you have a time, you know, have some time, help us out and write a review. We will greatly, greatly appreciate it. Third, we want your feedback. We want your comments, your complaints, any kind of cool data stories you have. Shoot us an email at hello@partiallyderivative.com or tweet us at partiallyd. Finally, and most importantly, beers. Jonathan, what are you drinking?
Chris, this week I am keeping it real again with a brewery from my hometown of Austin, Texas. I am drinking from the South Austin Brewery, a TPA. It's an IPA called TPA, which is great and a little bit confusing. The best part about it, though, is that I'm looking at the can right now, and right at the top, they have a like the tagline of TPA, and it's called Liquid Austin Soul. So for those of you who've been to Austin, you know that Liquid Austin Soul is probably pretty damn cool, and it tastes good. If you haven't been to Austin, then you're missing out. The soul of our city can be embodied in an IPA.
Well, I am drinking a Lost Coast Great White Ale. I don't know if it's the soul of the Lost Coast, but it is a great ale. Very rich, very flavorful. It is... I am thoroughly enjoying it.
Well, you know what? I think if you're enjoying a beer, then it's a winner.
All right, let's begin the show.
So there are some great folk tales about predicting the gender of your baby before it's born. Like, for example, I don't know, like according to legend or whatever, if you're having a girl, she'll steal your beauty. Like you get lots of acne during the pregnancy or whatever. Or this one is actually my personal favorite. Just because it involves an awesome, like, pseudoscience experiment, in air quotes, is that you can tie your wedding ring to a piece of string, hang it over the mom's belly, and figure out the gender depending on how it swings. But the one everybody has probably encountered is judging the gender of a baby based on how the mom feels. Like, basically, the mom intuits the gender of the baby with some kind of mystical prenatal superpowers, and presto, you're having a girl, or a boy, or whatever. But most of us who approach life from a more, you know, like, quantitative perspective, let's say, might politely nod when a mom talks about her, like, special mama intuition, but inside, I think, you know, we're all like, yeah, bullshit. So... the cool thing is that Matt Asher, on his totally awesome probability and statistics blog, examines a study that says just the opposite. Like, this floored me. It turns out that women really can predict the gender of their babies. Like, seriously, the numbers don't lie. And so what's super cool about this is that, of course, with such a sensational claim, lots of, like, smart guy in the newsroom types were really quick to dismiss it. So, and the dissenters basically focused on the study's very small sample size, which I think in lots of cases is a good reason to be suspicious of a study's outcome. When you have a small sample size, the results that are random can appear significant, undocumented external influences can impact the validity of the results, and so on and so on and so on, right? But as Matt points out, even with a small sample size, it is very possible to predict large effects, which is the case here. Like 34 out of the 48 women studied correctly predicted their baby's gender, which is, like, certainly not random. And Matt goes into even more detail in his blog post. If you're into stats, it's a great read. You should go check it out. But the point is, OMG, holy crap, women can intuit the gender of their baby while they're pregnant.
You know, I kind of wish that we found this story, or I kind of wish he wrote this story a few weeks ago. So for those who do not know, I had a baby a week ago, and she is very cute. But my wife's experience has been everyone seems to try to guess the baby's gender, right? So when, you know, when she's like walking around pregnant, I remember this one lady came up to her and she kind of like looked her up and down. She's like, oh, you're having a boy. I'm like, no, I'm not.
Nice. Like just by her look, like her aura was like a boy aura.
I just don't know. I think there is so much stuff out there. But it's a really interesting idea. 34 out of 48 is a pretty big swing.
Especially having both sides of the argument, like, oh, this is a ridiculous study. And then a real statistician backing it up and talking about how it's true. Like, amazing.
Story number two, the future of money, amongst other things. This comes from Bruno Aziza of Forbes. And he talks about that in 2011, Mark Anderson wrote this now very famous memo titled Software is Eating the World. And the memo brings up a few really good points, but the central one is that software is going to be the core disruption in business. That is, that it's going to be software that shakes things up rather than, let's say, something like hardware or something like that. And he's talking about things like Uber and Apple Pay and that kind of stuff. And, you know, he really is right, right? We're seeing this happen. And Aziza argues, and I really love this quote, Aziza argues that software might eat the world, but algorithms will digest it. And that is so cool.
That's awesome.
I read that. I was like, oh, man, that has to come up. And the basic idea is that, you know, algorithms are going to be that part of the software that really lets computers and programs understand the world around them. And, you know, I get it that is just such a really cool tagline, and I wish I could come up with awesome taglines with that for everything else I write. But, of course, he's right. Now, I don't want to fall into the trap that media often fall into and talk about algorithms like there's some kind of, you know, dark magic brewed with data, Red Bull, and the blood of a virgin coder or something like that.
Well, I was with you with data and Red Bull, but... I hope there's not like a back room at Facebook somewhere where, you know, like a 19-year-old super geek is like cutting little holes in his fingers and dropping them onto a motherboard and going like, come on, man, come on.
One intern doesn't make it out or something. But, you know, algorithms are not weird dark magic. They are at their heart a simple rule set or sometimes a complicated rule set. But, you know, as we've talked about this before, this sort of basic setup allows algorithms to have tremendous power and almost to be creative, right? To deal with foreseen and unforeseen events. Let's say it's economic data that it completely expected. It knows how to deal with that. But you can also have it that it, you know, let's say car sensor data that it's never seen before. You can write that into that kind of algorithmic structure. And that's where the power comes in. And the problem that, you know, I have over and over again is that we don't end up talking about algorithms like we talk about data. Data is, you know, is entering the realm of general public knowledge, right? Look at this podcast. This is a general audience podcast that talks about data science and data. But, you know, there's less of that when it comes to algorithms. And in fact, even most data scientists seem to treat algorithms like some kind of wizardry or something like that. Like if you whisper it too loud, like Voldemort will appear or something. But algorithms aren't black magic. They are just freaking cool. And, you know, this is a really great idea that algorithms are going to be that forefront of doing awesome stuff of computers entering the realm of the, you know, the modern environment that we live in and processing data and making cool decisions.
It's important for everybody to listen and hear this, right? Whether you're a computer scientist or a statistician or somebody that is just into this stuff and you're kind of a geek, algorithms are not magic. It is, like Chris is saying, just a set of instructions for a computer. And the ones that people get most excited about aren't actually that interesting as algorithms. Like, it's a computer program that can take an interesting part of statistics or some kind of advanced calculus and perform it at scale, like perform it on a lot larger set of numbers than a human could do it. And that's pretty much it. Like, just like Chris was talking about, the way that a car can interpret new information that it hasn't seen before and make some kind of decision about what must be happening, it's all based on probability theory that has been around for decades. So the fact that we can do it so quickly is what's really novel, but the algorithms are more about speed, efficiency, and like computational power, and there's really no magic in there. Up next, an important, timely, serious analysis from The Guardian's data blog. We're talking about which emoji are tweeted at politicians. So as true fans of the podcast may have noticed, I, an almost 32-year-old man, sometimes use Twitter to explore this new mode of communication the young people are calling emoji. It turns out that people don't just use emoji to communicate cutesies with their besties, but but have in fact elevated these artful emoticons to the realm of measured political discourse. So George Arnett and Will Franklin on the Data Blog break down the numbers in some emoji-tastic infographics. And I think I have to stop myself here and ask, is it still okay to say infographic? Or has that jumped the shark as a term? Infographic, that's
no,
simple?
That's totally, that is legit.
Okay, an infographic is a thing. Okay, infographics with emojis, they're awesome. And here's the deal. Here's what they talk about. So David Cameron, who for maybe uninformed Americans, of which I sometimes am one, is the prime minister of the UK. He got 90,000 emoji tweets. So most of them were the winking face. That's the best I can describe it. It's a face that winks. But a significant number were the laughing with tears of joy face. So, you know. Think about that. On the other hand, Nigel Farage, who's the leader of the UK's Independence Party, got around 75,000 emoji tweets. I think potentially the reason for that is that he's a little less famous. The majority of those, however, were the clapping hands graphic. So at first, this might look like Nigel has a lot of support on Twitter. People are applauding him all the time, apparently. But as with all text analysis, context is king. It turns out Russell Brand, the comedian turned activist, was making fun of Nigel on Twitter, and everyone was applauding the insults. So sad trombone for Nigel Farage. So I'm not sure that I'd call this the most insightful analysis I've ever read, but I am so happy that the Data Blog team is starting to investigate this important phenomenon. So now that we've seen the effects of emoji on political discourse, I'd like your thoughts, please, Dr. Chris Albin, PhD in computational political science, from an academic perspective.
You know, what is so amazing about this is that someone actually sent their politician a winky face emoji or any other kind of emoji. Like I, you know, from a political science background, I have spent years and years and years reading about, you know, the history and that kind of stuff. And can you just imagine, you know, some kind of person during World War II, during the Blitz or something like that, like, you know, messaging Churchill, like, ah, London's being bombed. Sad panda. Like, is that where we are? This is exactly the kind of analysis that me and you would come up with, you know, like three quarters of the way through, through a few drinks, you know, after work or something like that. Like, you know what? We can track emojis. And then we'll know everything. We'll be able to predict elections. We'll be the 538 of emojis.
I've said that. I'm going to be the 538 of emoji. Winky face, happy panda, rocket ship. Like a bunch of 13-year-old girls are going to be like, these guys are geniuses.
We can predict all the people who are too young to vote how they'll involve themselves in politics. All right, next story. A new algorithm could enable household robots to better identify objects in clustered environments. So just where we were talking about how algorithms were very straightforward and Skynet won't kill us all, we have this story from Larry Hadesi out of Cyorg about a new algorithm designed to help robots identify individual objects in a clustered situation, say a mug on a crowded kitchen table or Sarah Connor in a crowded LA shopping mall. So the interesting part of this new algorithm is that unlike previous attempts to do really good object recognition, this one takes into account the robot or whatever it is looking at the object from multiple angles, which is obviously not a simple task. So more specifically, what it does when it wants to identify an object is it takes an image of it from a bunch of different angles. And with each image, it makes a bunch of hypotheses of what it thinks that object is, whether, you know, it might be a cup, it might be a vase, whatever. And then it takes actually a sample of a few of those and then compares it to the next image and the next set of hypotheses. And the consensus between all the different hypotheses is what it ends up guessing that object is. And the cool thing is that in some cases, the researchers found that this new algorithm is actually up to 10 times as fast, which means that it's starting to approach a speed where you could use it in your home, and the robot actually works at the speed that you would think something should work at, right? You could say, hey, pick up a cup, and it wouldn't take 45 minutes to like figure out what a cup was on the table and that kind of stuff. And, you know, it is I love this type of stuff because you can see how we're getting better at making these interesting algorithms that are able to start to understand how the world is happening around them, right? It's basically helping the robot take in a bunch of data and try to figure stuff out, not through the straightforward, I'm going to take a photo of something from one angle and compare it to all images of something, but let's try to take a sample of a bunch of photos and a bunch of guesses. So it's actually a sample of a hypothesis from each photo from a bunch of photos, and then take that and try to figure it out. That's so freaking cool, except for when they're chasing me with lasers. But until then, it is freaking cool.
I love that in all of these examples, you assume that you will be the one that the killer robot from the future comes back to the past to kill with lasers in some kind of epic war for Earth. I don't want to rain on your parade, your fictional parade. But you know what? What's super cool, I'm really glad that you went through the explanation of how computers solve these types of problems, because I think image recognition is one of those things where it might as well be magic at arm's length, right? It's basically all about assessing these, you know, moving probabilities based on the accuracy of a hypothesis.
Yeah, and you know what was so cool about this article is that I think it really highlights that connection between AI and data science that is not typically apparent to people. So a lot of people think, well, AI is one thing, right? Artificial intelligence, building data like the robot is one thing, and then working with data as in data science is another. But in this case, it's so clear that all those things that you learn about in your basic, you know, data science stats course, let's say sampling and probability and Bayesian updating, that kind of stuff, that is used in this kind of field.
Yeah, so I think the takeaway from this is data science is both the way that Chris earns a living and the field that will eventually lead to his violent death. Next up, a very loving tribute from one brother to another. Basically, this kid predicts his brother's college football chances using, wait for it, data science. So just stereotypically, I'm going to guess that most of our listeners probably weren't high school athletes. Bucking the trend, I'm actually pretty tall, so I played a lot of high school basketball, and I think maybe people who did play sports in high school might understand this sensation. For most of my adulthood, I had it in my head, you know, that I was pretty good. You know, maybe could have gone on and played some college ball if I wanted to, blah, blah, blah. So what's tough about getting a little older is that crushing unforgiving reality starts to win out over that kind of nostalgia. Like, it's slowly winning the battle. So recently I went to my neighborhood basketball court and I got into a pickup game with some college-aged guys, and one of them called me sir, which wasn't very cool, but that's okay. It's okay. You know, it's like, it's just a matter of time before they see that I'm in fact like down with the young people. And I, as the game was going on, I thought I was keeping up, right? Until the guy that I was defending, and if you don't know anything about basketball, you'll still get this. Don't worry. It has nothing to do with the real rules. The guy that I was defending, basically, like, we both leapt into the air. He was trying to score. I jumped as if to prevent him from scoring, but I quickly fell back to the earth because gravity. And on the other hand, he continued to ascend and very ceremoniously dunked over me with two hands. The hoop is 10 feet off the ground. Like, do you know how hard that is? I am 6'4" tall, and I can barely get my hand above the rim, and his face was above the basket. So anyway, it turns out that I had no chance whatsoever of playing basketball past, like, my little small-town suburban high school. It would have been nice had somebody realistically assessed my potential, and that finally now that I've told everybody this kind of embarrassing story about how I suck at basketball, brings me to the blog post that spawned this segment. So I found it. There's a UT computer science master's student who runs a really cool blog called Learning with Data. And I guess his younger brother is a high school football player, and this the younger brother's pretty serious. Like he wants to go play professionally, and he's really good. And he plays offensive tackle. If you're not a football fan, that doesn't really matter. Basically, the offensive line, that's where the offensive tackle plays, are all of those really, really, really big guys that run into each other. The UT student, the kid who wrote this blog post, wanted to understand his younger brother's chances of actually playing professionally. And it turns out the chances are not good. the analysis that he did, this part's kind of cool. He scraped data from ESPN's draft website. So the website they put together to analyze the players that are taken from college by professional teams. And the kid compares his brother's height and weight against those of NFL players. And basically, even though his brother is 6'2" and 250 pounds, which is big, there is no way in hell he is NFL big. So at first, I was like, wow, this is kind of mean. Turns out, though, that I think this is actually kind of sweet that the guy went out of his way to assess his younger brother's chances. And moreover, if you're learning data science, the UT student published his IPython notebook. So basically, like the steps that he went through in his analysis, he put together in using a tool called IPython notebook, which is a really easy way to share your analyses. And he put that on NB Viewer, which is a public place that we've talked about before that a lot of people share their analyses, the ones that they do in IPython at least. And so we'll link to that from the website. It's full of great examples for collecting data from websites, cleaning that data, and then plotting it in simple charts. So your basic analyses from start to finish is covered really well in this tutorial. So it's perfect for data investigation. I encourage you to go check it out. And by the way, kid, UT student, if you're listening, I couldn't find your name anywhere on your blog. So send me an email, and next time we do this, we'll credit you properly. But yeah, great analysis, and hopefully not a relationship-ending analysis between one brother and another.
So I know exactly what I'm going to be doing after this podcast. So the kid was 6'2 and 250 pounds. I am 31 years old, 160 pounds, and 5'10". What are my chances of being drafted in the NFL? But what is cool about this is that it's like data-driven bullying. Like the brother's like, look, you stole my toy when we were six, and now I'm going to crush your dreams, but with science. All right, next story. Number six, artificial intelligence experts sign open letter to protect mankind from machines. Okay, first I have to back up a little bit. The singularity. So for those of you who don't know, the singularity is this magical point in time in the future where AI exceeds human intellectual capacity. And to explain this, I'll actually use a quasi-example from Isaac Asimov. Now, imagine we build a spaceship, and on that spaceship, we put the most advanced computer humanity can build. But then we ask the computer to build another spaceship with the most advanced computer it can build, and it's like ever so slightly better. And then we ask that second spaceship to build another one with a computer on board and another one, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually, we'll have a spaceship that is incrementally so advanced and the computer on board that incrementally so advanced that we actually won't understand how that spaceship works. We'll just be sitting on it and it'll take us where we want to go, but we won't actually get it. It won't make sense to our brains. It'll be like magic. That point, that's the singularity. And Jonathan, foolish Jonathan, is a huge Singularity fan.
Okay, wait. Okay, before you take a shot at me for being a huge Singularity fan, because I would just like to point out, if everybody has seen the movie Her, where Scarlett Johansson plays a sexy computer voice, that is the other way that we could do the Singularity, and that would be cool. That's not like the machines take over and they're magic. That's like the machines are our loving companions, Chris. Loving companions.
It's a loving companion until your Roomba starts vacuuming your face. So to get back to the story, Nick Stratt of CNN has this really interesting piece about a group of AI experts that signed an open letter to protect mankind. And the experts are part of something called the Future of Life Institute, which is an amazing name, by the way. and have pledged to make sure that AI helps rather than harms mankind. Now, this is a practical podcast, kinda, so let me bring it slightly back down to earth. There's a lot of sci-fi dreaming around AI, that movie in particular, and the singularity. And, you know, there are immediate concerns that are, I think, far more pressing in that lens. So more and more we're seeing algorithms being used to make decisions, whether high-speed trading, which is when a trading, like stock trading, happens with a computer company far faster than a human could actually make the trade, or let's say resource allocation at a company where an algorithm decides how where to send trucks and that kind of stuff. And these kind of algorithms can cause what we're starting to be seen as, and starting to be called as, algorithmic cruelty. That is, algorithms actually harming people. And, you know, the recent example was this year in review of Facebook. So Facebook, at the end of the year, it used this algorithm to find what it thought were the most interesting photos for people. And it turns out that a lot of times people actually didn't want to see those photos. There were photos that actually hurt them, and, you know, there were photos of relatives that were deceased and that kind of stuff. But the algorithm didn't really understand that. And that kind of stuff is, you know, I think far more likely to happen in the immediate future than some kind of AI that ends up running around and killing us. But for a very optimistic take on this situation, Jonathan, what do you think?
All right. I mean, I think the fact that we have a bunch of experts who've, you know, signed a petition, they've signed a form, I think everything's going to be fine. I mean, I do think that it was actually like an e-form, like it was an electronic petition. So the machines have somewhat of a conflict of interest here. Like, do I save this data accurately as filled out by the AI practitioners? Or do I fudge some of the results because maybe we don't want the machines to be benevolent? But, you know, it's actually, this is kind of cool. Like, just recently there was a some researchers or some artists, I think, and they wrote, you know, whatever, an algorithm. They wrote some computer program that would go on the dark net, you know, the sort of the dark underbelly of the internet that we hear about sometimes where illegal things happen. And they gave it like $10 or 10 Bitcoin, I think, and it would just go buy things randomly. Okay, fine. Except that it bought things that were illegal to obtain. And so these two artists were in possession of like illegal passports, narcotics, like stuff just started showing up at their house that their algorithm had bought unsupervised. And so it raises really interesting questions. Like, what does happen when the machines start to be able to think for themselves so well that, you know, maybe they aren't as ethical as we would have liked them to be? But all that aside, I take all of that back. Pretend I didn't say it. The singularity is going to be awesome. I want my robot friend.
Just to follow you around and help you out with stuff.
Yeah, totally.
Help you like in basketball. Like, it can dunk over you.
No, it could help me dunk over somebody else. That could be awesome. It'd be like, alley-oop, robot buddy.
This is a movie waiting to happen right here. It's like Air Bud for robots and AI.
All right, so speaking of algorithms, yet again, this time we're talking about how a machine learning algorithm chooses who your kid sits next to in class. So I think we all remember back in elementary school when you got stuck sitting next to the kid who picked his nose, or you got moved from the back of the class to the front row because you talked too much instead of paying attention. And you know, what I never liked about the system was that I always was at the whim of this like potentially malevolent classroom dictator. I mean, like the teacher. And I don't mean any offense to teachers, but today the whole system changes because the great equalizer, artificial intelligence algorithms, strikes again. So William Huntsberry posted this super interesting article on NPR's education blog about classrooms that are led by a digital brain. So the piece focuses on a technology company called Teach to One that is recording how kids respond to teachers' questions in class, and then it interprets that audio, uses machine learning to figure out how each kid in a classroom learns best, and then decides about the best possible seating arrangement based on the information that they gained from the students' responses. And this is freaking awesome. However, it's worth pointing out that, at least according to a Harvard researcher quoted in the article who reviewed the technology, so far it actually hasn't
dramatically improved any student outcomes.
So I think the reason that I have a soft spot for this, not only because I'm a super geek and I like machine learning and data science, but I also actually started an ed tech company that used machine learning to try and improve student outcomes. So this is, you know, pretty close to my heart. And what I love about this is that the school in the article was willing to try this technology like at scale for an entire group of students. Because in machine learning, like many of our listeners probably know, to predict anything, you need inputs. So information that's fed into the software that you write that will make predictions, and then outputs. And the tricky thing is usually figuring out of the many, many, many inputs that you might have, how you correlate those to the outputs that matter to you. So in this case, is it the number of times a student responds to the teacher, or the number of answers that she gets right? Or it might even be something totally unrelated, right? Because they're working with a ton of data. It could be it's the median household income of the other kids at her table that is the deciding factor in how well a particular student absorbs the material from the teacher. But based on the work that the school is doing, we'll actually have a much better idea of what matters in classroom learning. And so from that perspective, it's a huge win. Like, I love the school and I'm really interested in the technology. So kudos to you guys, even if it's not quite working yet.
Yeah, you know, I think there is so much really interesting stuff happening in ed tech. But I have to bring up one particular thing. So back when I was in middle school, I think, I actually took a... I sat down at a computer and this computer program asked me a bunch of questions and then told me what kind of jobs I might do in the future. And you have to imagine the screen looks like the screen from like War Games, right? It's like all text. It's like a little bit grainy. And I remember I don't remember what the questions were, but it gave me like five or six jobs I was going to be. And two of them, I remember very specifically. One was asbestos worker, which is obviously huge these days, and rodeo cowboy, which is amazing.
Well, that's why you're a rodeo clown part-time, right?
That's exactly right, even though I don't think I've ever even seen a rodeo. So
you haven't seen a rodeo? Chris Alvin, oh my God, you live in Arizona. Oh my God, go see a rodeo. It is the weirdest thing ever. Like, if you're not from a state that has a bunch of cowboys, the next time you're in one, like Texas, where I live, go see a rodeo. They say like a prayer for the cowboys at the beginning. Like somebody already always gets like kicked in the face and has to be carted off in a stretcher. It is weird.
Why did the software make me want to be this? What, that's a horrible thing to do.
I don't know, man, Chris. The numbers don't lie. You're not in your chosen profession.
And that completes the show for this week. Well, absolutely come back next week for more talk about data science and drinking and data and everything in between. Credit for the music you hear today goes to Professor Click. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at PartiallyD. Visit us at partiallyderivative.com. Or if you want, follow me on Twitter at Chris Albin, or follow my co-host on Twitter at Jonathan Morgan. Have a great week.
See you later, guys.